participants to onlookers. On the third morning, they were delayed in one of the towns Jason had passed through on his original journey to Greenstone. Vincent wasn't willing to turn away the quickly growing crowd of earnest sick people, so the town constable once again turned his office into a makeshift clinic. Stopping to help the locals delayed the group's monster hunting activities until the end of the morning. As Jason healed the sick, the grateful locals pulled out tables and benches, laying out a cornucopia of food for his companions. Some of the aristocratic candidates turned up their noses at a rustic feast until they started to smell the food. Once Humphrey started filling his plate with enthusiasm, the others followed his lead. Liana Stellin was one of the adventurer candidates who was acquainted with Humphrey. Their families moved in similar circles, and they had both failed the previous assessment together. Like Humphrey, her family wanted her to pass on merit rather than privilege. Sitting next to him on a bench, she asked Humphrey about Jason.
"How did you end up friends with him?" she asked. "Don't you find him insufferably smug?"
"He can be challenging," Humphrey said. "He's a long way from home, and I think he likes to put people off balance because it's how he feels all the time. He can be difficult and oblivious, but I think there's a kindness and generosity under it all. Look at what he's doing right now."
"Tell Thadwick Mercer about kindness and generosity," Liana said.
"That's fair," Humphrey said. "He can be mean and self-impressed when he's trying to prove how clever he is, which maybe isn't quite as clever as he thinks. He certainly won't get along with everyone. But look around us." He gestured around at the villagers and the feast laid out for them.
"How many adventurers get this kind of reception?"
"He gets along with common people because he's common. That and he's giving out free healing," she said. "My sister has healing powers. She could do the exact same thing."
"But does she?" Humphrey asked. In the constable's cottage, the last person shuffled out.
"That's everyone?" Vincent asked.
"I think so," Jason said. The constable nodded.
"You know," he said, "it would make my life easier if you'd warn me you're coming through instead of just turning up."
"That's on the boss man," Jason said, jabbing a thumb in Vincent's direction. "He sets the destination."
"Did I hear something about lunch being put on?"
That night, they were stopped in another little town where they had taken up all four of the inn's twin rooms. Humphrey and Jason were sitting on their beds because there wasn't space anywhere else in the cramped twin chair. Jason was going over the clothing in his hands, examining the ragged claw marks in the light of a magic lamp.
"This cloth armor doesn't hold up so well," Jason said.
"Well, it is cloth," Humphrey said. "If you want real protection out of it, you need to spend more on the magic. Or you could try something heavier."
"I didn't like the leather I was finding," Jason said. "It was either too stiff and restrictive or too expensive for what it did. I have a good amount of money, but that doesn't mean I'm all right with being ripped off."
"All the best armor is bought and sold at the Adventure Society Trade Hall," Humphrey said. "Once we pass the test, you can buy something there. How well does that cloak power of yours protect you?"
"I did some testing with Gary," Jason said. "It doesn't hold up to bronze-level attacks at all, which was no surprise. It's really good against cutting attacks, so that's a lot of swords, knives, and claws." He looked down at the claw marks in his magically treated cloth. "So long as they actually hit the cloak, anyway. Stabbing attacks punch through a bit better, like those spines that monster shot at me yesterday."
"And blunt attacks?"
"The cloak doesn't cushion them at all."
"That's a shame," Humphrey said. "A lot of monsters are just big, tough, and try to batter you to death."
"That's where the unrestricted movement comes in."
"Maybe you can show that off tomorrow," Humphrey said. "I went with Instructor Trenslow to take the notices from the board, and we're going after a bark lurker."
"Bark lurker?"
"I think it's some kind of troll."
"I'll look it up."
Jason pulled a tablet of white and blue marble from his inventory. At Farrah's suggestion, Jason had purchased the active monster registry from the Magic Society.
It contained all the information the Magic Society had about monsters and was updated along with the Magic Society's own archives. There was an index on the tablet, seemingly engraved in gold script, but the engraving shifted as Jason touched his finger to the inscribed letters. "You're right," Jason said, as he read from the tablet. "It is a form of troll, less intelligent than most troll varieties, but has the usual troll resilience and rapid healing. Vaguely human-shaped, but stands twice as tall. Usually dwells in swampland, has a hard, bark-like shell, but due to its thickness, the shell plates leave exposed areas around the joints. Usually slow and uncoordinated, but can demonstrate bursts of rapid movement. It can breathe water and likes to hide near the water's edge, mimicking a submerged log." "What about numbers?" "Almost always manifests alone," Jason read, "except during a monster surge." "There you are," Humphrey said. "Big and slow, only one to deal with, sounds perfect for an affliction specialist."
"If I see it coming," Jason said, "I'll need to bait it out somehow."
"Maybe after this, Trenslow will finally pass you. I don't understand why he hasn't already."
"He's not satisfied with my performance. That's easy enough to figure out."
"You've done just as well as any of the others who passed."
"Except for you," Jason said. "You're head and shoulders above the rest of us, yet Trenslow kept pushing before he passed you. He was holding you to a higher standard."
"You think that's what's happening?" Humphrey asked.
"Rufus came out of last month's assessment with a pretty high opinion of the instructor," Jason said. "Now that he will be around longer than he thought, he doesn't feel the need to rush me along so much. It wouldn't surprise me if it turned out Rufus had a little talk with Trenslow to make sure he fails me if I'm not up to the standard Rufus wants."
"You think he's going to fail you?" Humphrey asked.
"Probably," Jason said. "You've seen Rufus's standards."
"You shouldn't give up yet," Humphrey said. "Go all out. Give it everything. You might impress him so much that he has to pass you."
The group of adventurer candidates were assembled on a huge grassy field while one of their members fought a monster. There was enough neatly cut grass for a good-sized sports arena, and it was just as flat. There were a few buildings around the edges, some of which looked to be good-sized barns. With the scarcity of lumber-worthy wood, they were primarily constructed out of mud brick.
"What is all this for?" Jason wondered.
"What do you mean?" Humphrey asked.
"Every part of the delta that isn't underwater is being put to efficient use," Jason said. "Except for the part some rich people walled off for themselves anyway."
Humphrey gave him a side glance, but said nothing.
"This is good grass," Jason said, crouching down and rubbing some blades beneath his fingers. "Real good grass. Like a St. Augustine. Someone's been taking care of it, too. Is this a turf farm?"
"What's a turf farm?" Liana asked.
"The island is an artificial island made of stone," Humphrey said. "When people want to landscape their grounds, they have much of the actual work done here in the delta, then transported over as slabs of earth. All that grass in the park district was grown in places like this."
"I take it everyone cleared out when the monster showed up," Jason said.
"They did," Vincent said. "It isn't the first time they've had monsters wander along. You seem strangely knowledgeable about grass."
"My dad's a landscape architect," Jason said.
"Is that what it sounds like?" Humphrey asked.
"Pretty much," Jason said. "He designs big, fancy gardens."
"So he's a gardener," Liana said.
"Pretty much," Jason said. "A well-trained, highly paid gardener, but yeah."
Vincent made an unhappy noise at the fight going on in the distance. It wasn't going well. Most monsters at Iron Rank did not boast exotic abilities. Some might shoot quills or rapidly heal, but they were largely reliant on their physical attributes. One of the rare exceptions was the rune tortoise, a creature with blue skin and a turquoise shell that was only around a meter long. The danger came from its shell, where every segment had a glowing rune, each of which could produce a different magical effect.
The key challenge in facing a rune tortoise was that each one had a unique set of runes. The wide variety of potential abilities made it an unpredictable enemy. As he had done with each of the more difficult creatures, Vincent took the time to explain the creature and the best way to fight it. In the case of the rune tortoise, its weakness was that after using an ability, it took time for that ability to become available again. The key to defeating it was baiting out the abilities, after which it was no more dangerous than a regular tortoise. Looking out at the fight in progress, Jason saw several of its runes had dimmed after use. The tortoise had not spent them cheaply, however, as could be seen from the would-be adventurer trying to hunt it. His hair was blackened where it wasn't burned off entirely, his skin smeared and cracked, his armor had been shattered, his clothing reduced to rags. "That's enough, Mobley," Vincent called out. "If you go back in, it will probably kill you."
"I can take it," the bedraggled candidate yelled back.
Jason observed that the tortoise was possibly withdrawing from the fight. At the pace it moved, it was quite hard to tell.
"You probably can," Vincent called out to Mobley. "But being an adventurer is about dealing with monsters, not probably dealing with them."
"I have silver spirit coins," Mobley shouted. "I'll make short work of it."
Vincent shook his head.
"Putting aside that we are assessing you, not your wallet," Vincent said, "look at the state of you. Do you really want to use something that will render healing potions worthless?"
"There's only the one monster," Mobley said.
"This time it's only one," Vincent said. "The next time it might not be. Come back over here."
Mobley glared at Vincent.
"You'll fail me if I don't kill it, won't you?"
Mobley yelled miserably.
"Even if you kill it," Vincent called back, "I'll fail you on the spot for taking the risk. Otherwise, you have the rest of the assessment to prove yourself."
"Risk as what adventurers do,"
Mobley yelled, pleadingly. Of the three candidates yet to pass, one was trudging a bedraggled path back to the group. The others were Jason and a young woman staring uneasily at Mobley's charred state.
"Either of you care to volunteer?" Vincent asked. "Or do I send Humphrey?"
"I'm happy to go, unless you want it," Jason said to the young woman. "It's already gone through most of its abilities."
She looked at the state Mobley was in and shook her head.
"No, you go ahead," she told him.
"Think you can handle it, Asano?"
Vincent asked. Jason set off towards the tortoise at a casual stroll, which still outpaced the tortoise at full flight.
"I'll muddle through," he said.
Chapter 56. Gary's Gift. Jason and Mobley passed each other as Jason walked in the direction of the rune tortoise.
"Sorry, mate," Jason commiserated.
The burned and blackened would-be adventurer just shot him a contemptuous look and kept walking. Jason wasn't sure if it was the immediate circumstances that drew the man's ire or just general dislike. Jason had become an outsider to the group, for a couple of reasons. The first was Jason's unusual mannerisms and general disregard for status and etiquette. The same traits that helped him get along with the people in every town and village they passed through didn't endear him to the wealthy scions that made up his fellow candidates. For them, status was everything, and only someone like Humphrey, born at the very top of the pile, could disregard it. The other reason they disliked him was his friendship with Humphrey. The Geller family stood at the peak of Greenstone society, and their local power was just a fragment of their world-spanning influence. On top of that, Danielle Geller was the strongest adventurer to come out of Greenstone in generations. Building a friendship with her son was a ticket to the top, not just for an adventurer, but their entire family. For some of the candidates, making a connection with Humphrey was more important than passing the field assessment. Having their chances monopolized by Jason left them increasingly rankled. Jason didn't much like those who shunned him for this reason, finding moments to tell him that he should know his place. He much preferred someone like Liana Staline, who disliked him for himself rather than having an agenda.
Jason moved forwards until he was just outside what he estimated to be the maximum range for the rune tortoise's powers, based on its battle with Mowgli. He had a new wristband, which had a small razor that could be easily pushed in and out of a sheath. The tiny blade was in no way an effective weapon, but the sharp edge was perfect for quickly and easily drawing a shallow line of blood on the back of his hand. Holding the cut away from him, leeches started spraying out of the wound like he'd knocked the side off a fire hydrant.
"Now I know what an emptying balloon feels like," he muttered.
"All right, Colin. Fetch!"
What came next was a slow-motion pursuit, as Jason's sedately ambulating pile of leeches undulated in the direction of the tortoise's soporific escape.
"I know there isn't a strict time constraint," Vincent called out, "but we do have other monsters to get to."
"Don't worry," Jason called back. "Colin is just my stalking horse."
The rest of the group looked on with varying reactions.
"Are those leeches?"
"Did he say Colin?"
"What's a horse?"
Jason trailed well behind his familiar. His concern was that the tortoise had failed to notice it, so he pulled out a throwing knife. The skill book had given him proficiency with an array of weaponry, but Rufus had concentrated training on only a few. As Jason's primary weapon was his poison dagger, Rufus had focused on various knife techniques, even throwing.
"They won't deal any real damage," Rufus had explained as he introduced Jason to throwing knives. "But they can offer some utility, or distract an enemy in a critical moment. Putting some poison on them wouldn't be a terrible idea either."
Jason tossed the knife, but it was a long throw. Jason maintained distance, but landed an embarrassing few meters to the left of the tortoise. He turned around to face the group.
"New knives," he yelled at them. "I'm still getting used to them."
A second attempt also missed, but the third bounced off the tortoise's shell with a barely audible thud, rather than the satisfying clank Jason had been expecting. I think movie sound effects have given me unrealistic expectations for how cool the world sounds. There was a sharp crack as an arc of electricity erupted out of the shell in reaction. It didn't reach Jason, instead blasting into his familiar, sending scorched leeches scattering about. On the tortoise's shell, one of the runes dimmed away.
"Actually, that sounded amazing," Jason said, looking at the burned and blackened remains of leeches. The pile was about a third smaller.
"You all right, buddy?" Jason called out. "Wobble to the left if you're all right."
The pile moved slightly left as it continued the pursuit. The tortoise slowly turned to face its new opponents. Jason observed there were only three runes still glowing on the tortoise, after which it would be no more powerful than an ordinary tortoise of its size. Another rune faded as a huge globule of water shot into the air, then burst into mist. From the mist, bullets of water started shooting down into the leech pile, but the water didn't seem to have a huge effect on the leeches. In the wake of the water bullet's failure, the penultimate rune faded, and the humid delta air was suddenly stirred into motion. Directly over the pile of leeches, a small but powerful dust devil formed, sucking up the leeches and scattering them to the wind. One even slapped into Jason's face, which he peeled off with a frown. As the wind faded, Jason looked around at the leeches cast as far as dozens of meters away.
"You did good, little guy," Jason said, moving the leech to the back of his hand, where it disappeared into the cut. "You just gather yourself back together while I deal with the mean tortoise."
Jason looked over at the tortoise, which only had one remaining rune lit up. Confident he could handle one ability, he started closing in on the sluggish monster. The tortoise, for its part, made a very optimistic dash for freedom as Jason strolled in its direction. When Jason reached it, it ducked its head and limbs into its shell. The last rune dimmed as the tortoise's body took on a metallic sheen. Jason crouched down to peer into the openings where the tortoise had disappeared into its shell. Some kind of plate had moved into place at each of them.
"I've seen this ability," Vincent said. He had startled Jason, who was sure he'd seen Vincent back with the others just moments earlier and hadn't felt the approach of his aura. "This is probably the strongest ability a rune tortoise has," Vincent said.
How so?
It massively increases its defense, Vinson said. It'll take a bronze rank attack to break in, and a strong one at that. Even worse for you, it makes it immune to afflictions.
How long can it keep it up?
Not sure, Vincent said. Certainly long enough for its powers to come back. I'll deal with it now.
Hold on, Jason said. You're the one who asked for a volunteer, so let me sort it out.
You think you can get around this ability?
Easily, Jason said. There's a bunch of ways. It still needs to breathe, right? I don't know if it's aquatic or burrowing, but we could bury it or drown it. We could throw it off a great big cliff. I bet that'd crack it.
I don't think there's a lot of cliffs in the Delta.
I'm just saying there's options, Jason said. The one I'm going to go for is testing out a gift a friend gave me. Jason drew a sword from his inventory. It was simple but elegant in design, not overly long, with a straight double-edged blade. The hilt was red gold, the grip a dark, soft fabric. A short, simple tassel of the same black fabric dangled from the red-gold pommel. Other than knives, straight swords were the weapons Rufus had drilled Jason on the most, knowing Gary was already working on such a weapon for Jason. Taking it out, Jason smiled as he thought of the day Gary had presented it.
"We all wanted to give you something," Gary had told him when handing over the sword. "Farrah gave you that awakening stone, and Rufus the skill book. I made you this, and it turned out pretty well, I thought. It's not a big deal or anything."
Despite Gary's words, Jason could feel the care and effort that had gone into it. Magic items had auras of their own, and the aura of the sword was stronger than any other iron rank items Jason had encountered.
Item: Dread Salvation. Iron rank: Growth, legendary. A sword crafted with gratitude, in hope it would be of the greatest use in the moment of greatest need. It was forged with passion and expertise to be a reliable companion, bestowing upon it an incredible potential. Weapon: Sword. Effect: If a special attack that applies an affliction is made with this sword, but the subject of the attack has a physical immunity to it, an instance of Stonecutter is applied to the blade. Effect: If a special attack that applies an affliction is made with this sword, but the subject of the attack has a magical immunity to it, an instance of Spellbreaker is applied to the blade. Stonecutter, magic, stacking. All attacks deal additional resonating force damage, highly effective against physical defenses. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Spellbreaker, magic, stacking. All attacks deal additional disruptive force damage, highly effective against magical defenses and incorporeal entities. Additional instances have a cumulative effect. Growth conditions: bronze, 1 kilogram of blood gold, 4 kilograms of low grade bronze rank starfall silver, 100 bronze rank iron quintessence gems, 100 bronze rank magic quintessence gems, 1000 bronze rank spirit coins. Ritual of bronze ascension. Jason didn't read past the description before grasping Gary's huge, hairy body in a hug.
"I'm not really a hugger," Gary had said as he awkwardly returned the embrace.
"Well, you should be," Jason told him. "You're really good at it." Jason looked down at the bunkered tortoise, then back at his sword. He turned it over in his hand, watching the sun strike the clean edge.
"He's been secretly working on it for weeks," Rufus had told Jason later. "We don't really talk about it, but none of us thought we were getting out of that sacrifice chamber alive. We owe you a favor we can't ever repay."
Jason slapped him on the arm. "Friends don't count favors, Rufus. They just show up when they're needed." Jason looked down at the tortoise hunkered in its shell.
"Is something wrong, Mr. Asano?"
Vincent asked.
"Not at all."
Rather than bring the sword down on the shell, he casually stabbed the monster's side. "Special attack, punish, has inflicted sin on Rune Tortoise. Rune Tortoise is immune to afflictions. Sin does not take effect. Affliction immunity has triggered an effect on weapon, Dread Salvation. Weapon, Dread Salvation, has gained an instance of Stonecutter.
You may need a little more gusto to penetrate the protection.
Actually, Jason said, the key is persistence. Jason stabbed out again and again. With each strike, the sword became more powerful, until the first gouge appeared in the monster's side, a section of flesh chipped off like stone under the monster's protection ability.
I'm an affliction specialist, Jason told Vincent as he continued to chip away. We don't do speed. We do inevitability.
Chapter 57 Rainbow Smoke. Jason looked at the dead rune tortoise.
Sorry, mate, he told it. Can't have you going berserk and wandering into town shooting lightning bolts at people.
Apologizing to a dead monster? Vincent asked.
It might just be a congealed blob of magic, but it was still alive, and died trapped in its own shell. It might have only had an animal's intelligence, but it could feel helpless and afraid. It's a rough way to go.
You're an affliction specialist, Vincent said. It's always a rough way to go with you.
You know Humphrey breathes fire, right? Jason said. Burning to death can't be great either.
Jason tapped a finger on the dead creature's shell.
Would you like to loot Rune Tortoise?
Jason walked away before mentally accepting the loot.
Monster core, iron, has been added to your inventory. 5 lightning quintessence has been added to your inventory. 5 wind quintessence have been added to your inventory. 5 water quintessence have been added to your inventory. 5 fire quintessence have been added to your inventory. Intact rune tortoise shell has been added to your inventory. Shell skin potion has been added to your inventory. 10 iron rank spirit coins have been added to your inventory.
Behind him, the rune tortoise started dissolving into rainbow smoke, rising up into the air. The colourful display was as beautiful as the stench of it was horrifying, which was why Jason had learned not to loot monsters until he was some distance upwind. Having a power to harvest monsters, Jason discovered, was a rare and useful one. For most people, they had to use a specialized branch of ritual magic. It was something many learned, however, due to the lucrative rewards. Getting lucky and looting an awakening stone or an essence, even valuable crafting materials, paid out better than the contracts to kill the monster in the first place.
One of the candidates from last month had a looting power, Vincent said as he glanced back at the rising smoke.
Oh? Jason said. Is he in the other group this month?
Actually, he passed, Vincent said. One of the Mercer boys' lackeys, unfortunately. Damn waste of talent.
They reached the rest of the group, where Mobley had only partially healed up through potions. The group of candidates included a few with self-healing, like Jason, but no one who could help others in the group.
You ready for the next one?
Vincent asked, as he and Jason walked back to the group.
I am, Jason said.
Good, Vincent said. We've got a few more to get through today.
The mangrove swamp was wet and hot, the air full of tiny bugs. The mangroves were large and dense, shrouding the areas within in darkness. Passage through the swamp was either by shallow boat or along bridge road, an extended chain of low, flat bridges, spanning the distance between sporadic patches of solid ground. Most of the construction in the delta was either mud brick or yellow desert stone, but Bridge Road was built from the region's signature green stone. It reminded Jason of the impossible bridge that carried the Mistrun River over the massive gorge on its way down to the delta. He wondered if it had the same mysterious constructor. They were crossing Bridge Road in their wagon, which Vincent drew to a stop at a seemingly random point in the middle of the swamp. He turned back to address the adventurer candidates in the back.
Undeveloped areas like this can be some of the most dangerous in the Delta, Vincent explained. There's a lot of territory for monsters to go unnoticed until they hit the berserk stage. You won't need to deal with that today, though. We have 2 sets of monsters in this area, 1 single monster and 1 pack.
Vincent dropped down off the wagon, and the group clambered out the back.
After half a week, even the more spoiled members of the group had stopped complaining about the basic transport. Vincent gathered the group together on the side of the bridge.
"When you get a monster notice," Vincent said, "whether from a notice board or the Adventure Society directly, it has three pieces of information. So long as that information is known, the name of the monster, or a description, the number of monsters, and the approximate location." He panned a stern eye across the group. "What I am about to tell you is the most important thing you will learn during this assessment. It is the single greatest contributing factor to adventurer death, bar none. It's a simple thing, but if you disregard it, there's a very good chance you will die. If you routinely disregard it, your death is inevitable."
Vincent held the notice in his hand.
"This information is not reliable. It usually comes from local residents with limited understanding of monsters and who run the moment they see them. They may well recognize monsters common to their area, but monsters are misidentified on a regular basis. Descriptions are wrong. Numbers are vastly inflated or grossly underestimated. People even get the place they saw them wrong."
He waved the notice in their faces.
"Do not trust these notices. Prepare as best you can, not the best you can be bothered, and always be ready for everything to go horribly wrong. Most importantly, do not hesitate to run for the hills if something seems wrong. If you have any ideas about the dignity of an adventurer or a noble or whatever, then throw those ideas away or they will kill you. Your first duty as an adventurer is to come back alive. You can always come back with more people to kill the monster later."
Vincent took a cleansing breath.
"It is the responsibility of an adventurer to understand what they are walking into as best they can. In this case, our monster is a bark lurker. I know Geller warned you about it, Asano. Are you prepared?"
"I am," Jason said.
"Then you're ready to go?"
"I am."
"According to the notice," Vincent said, "there should be only one, somewhere in the vicinity of Bridge Marker 16.
He pointed to a stone marker on the side of the bridge, on which the number 16 was inscribed.
"As that is all the notice says, that is all the information you're getting. As I have just explained, however, that information is not reliable. Out in unclaimed territory, where the report was made by someone who fled off at first glance, there is every chance it is wrong. That said, most notices are fairly accurate, which is why you have to avoid becoming complacent."
Vincent held something out for Jason to take. It was a crystal, like the one floating over Vincent's head.
"A recording crystal?"
Vincent shook his head.
"A far sight crystal," he said. "As long as it's active, we can see through it from here. It has a maximum range, but the monster should be well within it."
"How does it work?"
"Just toss it in the air."
He did as instructed, and the crystal moved over Jason's head. In front of Vincent, an image appeared, showing the perspective from Jason's crystal. The image looked a lot like the interface screens that appeared for Jason's ability. Vincent adjusted the image with a flick of his hand, panning back for a wider view.
"Off I go, then," Jason said, walking to the edge of the bridge.
His cloak of shadows and stars appeared around him as he stepped off, drifting gently down to the water. He started walking over the surface of the water, his footfalls landing with a ripple. Standing on the water, he concentrated on the auras around him. The strongest were on the bridge, Vincent's bronze rank aura, the iron rank of the others. He moved his focus to the weaker auras around him. The swamp was teeming with life, inundating Jason with normal rank auras. Animals were sensitive to auras and avoided him, even the ones that would normally view a human as potential prey. Jason moved further from the bridge, still concentrating on the auras. He was looking for an aura dead zone, knowing the ordinary animals would give the unnatural monster a wide berth. He was out of sight of the bridge when he found what he was looking for. The normal auras were avoiding something, much as they avoided Jason himself. He wasn't close enough to pinpoint the source, as his aura sense was limited. Jason walked over to the mangroves at the edge of the water.
He picked a spot where the trees weren't too tightly packed, but still provided enough cover to make solid shadows. From his inventory, he took out a slab of meat, something looted from a monster several days ago. He wedged it in between the mangrove roots, just under the surface. The night before, Jason and Humphrey had pored over the monster archive entry for bark lurkers, looking for the best approach. What they had come up with was baiting the creature out with meat. Its ability to sense auras was weak, a trait common to humanoid monsters. Its sense of smell, on the other hand, was excellent, especially in water. Using monster meat made it less likely to attract normal creatures. Jason waited, well away from the bait. He stood stock still in the shadows of another set of mangroves, his aura retracted as best he could. He sensed the monster beneath the dark water before he spotted the ripples on the water as something large moved within it. He could see the monster barely broach the surface of the water. If it wasn't moving, he would have mistaken it for a log. It moved slowly at first, before splashing wildly as it lunged onto the submerged bait. It rose up out of the water, lifting the meat up in triumph as it let out a wild roar. It looked like a giant wearing armor made of swamp logs, water pouring off the pocked and craggy shell. Jason vanished into the shadows, emerging from those right next to the creature. His snake-toothed dagger easily found the gap between the thick sections of shell, cutting deeply into the flesh beneath. The creature's roar of triumph became one of startlement and pain. Weapon, Nightfang, has inflicted umbral snake venom on bark lurker. Special attack, Punish, has inflicted sin on bark lurker. Aura, Hegemony, reduces the resistance of enemies for each instance of sin. Jason danced away across the water, his boots moving lightly over the surface. The monster wheeled on him, wading sluggishly in pursuit. It was twice Jason's height, but it was waist deep in water, leaving them face to face. The slow creature was impeded all the more by having to wade through the swamp. Jason knew it would move faster if it swam underneath, but it was too enraged and too stupid to think tactically. He led it towards another patch of mangrove trees. Jason's back came up against the trees, and the monster thought it had him. It lurched forwards with a sudden burst of speed as Jason stepped back into the shadows of the mangrove trees. The monster crashed into the space he had just vanished from, becoming entangled in the trees. Jason emerged from the shadows just to the monster's side, again finding a gap in its bulky shell. Weapon, Nightfang, has inflicted umbral snake venom on bark lurker. Special attack, Leech Bite, has inflicted bleeding on bark lurker. The trees were little impediment to the monster's strength, whole root systems wrenched from the water as it thrashed about. It failed to find its attacker. Jason was already gone, emerging from the shadows of another patch of mangroves. The monster cast its gaze about, spotting Jason and resuming pursuit. As it did, Jason calmly watched its approach as he chanted a spell.
Your fate is to suffer.
Spell, Inexorable Doom, has inflicted Inexorable Doom on Bark Lurker. With the spell taking hold, Jason's victory became inevitable. The poison from the dagger would necrotize the creature's flesh, while the sin curse would make the necrosis even worse. The spell would cause both curse and poison to accumulate over time. The combination resulted in exponentially escalating damage that would inexorably overwhelm the monster. It did have a rapid healing ability, but the bleeding effect Jason inflicted would absorb at least some of that. He could have unleashed his familiar, but wanted to see what his abilities could do against a tough enemy. Jason led the creature along the edge of the mangroves, back in the direction of the road bridge. The creature continued its furious pursuit, slow wading interspersed with rushing bursts. Jason strolled casually over the surface of the swamp, shadow hopping through the shady mangroves as necessary to stay ahead. The road bridge was in sight when the monster was finally overwhelmed and fell dead. Jason went back to loot it as it sank into the water. The candidates gathered on the bridge watched Jason. Cloak of stars swirling around him on a breeze no one else could feel. He walked lightly over the water as a patch of swamp roiled behind him, disgorging rainbow smoke into the air.
Chapter 58 A Man of Malevolent Intellect. With the bark lurker dealt with, the group completed the crossing of Bridge Road, and mangroves gave way to marshland. Once again they were riding atop the embankment roads that were main thoroughfares of the Delta. Sitting in the back of the wagon, Jason looked out at the sun getting low over the wetlands, golden light shimmering on the water. The hour was fairly late, the summer causing the sun to linger in the sky. Jason took out a red marble tablet from his inventory, the image of a bird etched into it in gold. "What's that?" Humphrey asked. "Something I have to decide whether to keep or throw away."
"Why?"
"Probably best I don't say," Jason told him. "You know, Humphrey, my experiences in your little stretch of reality have been pretty extreme. I've had some rough moments." He looked out again at the sun setting over the wetlands. "Some good ones, too. Whatever complaints I may have had, things being bland isn't one of them."
"Shut up, Asano," Mobley said. "No one wants to hear your winsome prattling. You're not profound."
Humphrey was about to say something, but Jason waved him down with a gesture. Jason looked at Mobley, but didn't say anything either, shaking his head as he returned the tablet to his inventory. Vincent pulled the wagon to a halt at a junction where two embankment roads crossed one another.
"There's a good-sized town beyond the marsh," he told them, turning to look at the group sitting together in the wagon. "There's a dedicated accommodation for adventurers on the road, so you can expect the nicest night you'll have during this trip. Before that, though, there's one last notice for the day." He panned his eyes slowly over the group. Humphrey and the three others who had already passed, Jason and the young woman who could still go either way. His gaze stopped at Mobley, the one member who had ostensibly failed.
"I won't lie," Vincent said. "This is a rough one. I'm willing to let any or all of you participate. You can sort that out amongst you. Mobley, you make a good showing here, and I'm willing to reconsider your position."
Mobley had been sullenly slumped in the wagon since his encounter with the rune tortoise that morning. Potions and ointments had healed him, but his hair was still largely burned away. Jason had offered Mobley some hair growth ointment Jory had given him, but he wanted nothing to do with Jason. On hearing Vincent's offer, however, his head jerked up, hope lighting up his eyes.
"What's the monster?" Humphrey asked.
"Trap weavers," Vincent said.
Humphrey and some of the others took on serious expressions, recognizing the monster by name. The others waited for the explanation, but Mobley was the first to speak.
"Are you trying to get me killed?"
he asked wildly.
"Did someone put you up to this? It was the Kilgain family, wasn't it? They paid you to make sure I didn't come back."
The other candidates went as still as the suddenly frozen expression on Vincent's face. There was a long period of icy silence before Vincent spoke.
"Mr. Mobley," Vincent said, "I am willing to take that accusation in the manner I believe it was made, which is to say, thoughtlessly. So long as I have your apology, I am willing to consider it an outburst made in a moment of surprise, that we can put behind us and speak no more about."
Mobley visibly gulped. Jason could hear something dangerous lurking behind Vincent's words, as if his controlled enunciation was trying to keep it from getting loose. Suddenly the man with the outrageous mustache didn't seem silly at all.
"You have my apology, sir," Mobley said.
"Good," Vincent said.
"Mr. Geller, please inform the members of our group who are not aware as to the nature of trap weavers."
"Perhaps we should disembark from the wagon first," Humphrey suggested.
"Good idea, Mr. Geller."
Leaving the tense air of the wagon seemed like an escape. The marshland was vast, reeds and copses of trees punctuating expanses of water.
The air was heavy, wet and warm, even as the sun ducked out of sight. The sky was a mixture of dark blue and orange gold, reflected on the still mirror of marsh water.
"Instructor Trenslow," Humphrey said. "When you were collecting notices, I didn't see one for trap weavers."
"It came from the Adventure Society directly," Vincent said. "They have provided the location of the nest."
"Sir," Humphrey said, "trap weavers are dangerous, and this half-light will favour them strongly. Perhaps it would be best to come back in the morning."
"I asked you to inform the group of what trap weavers are, Mr. Geller," Vincent said. "I did not ask your opinion on how I conduct this field assessment."
"Sorry, sir," Humphrey said. "Trap weavers are a kind of giant spider. Their main body is around the size of a man's torso, but they stand as tall as a man with their long legs. They can produce webs that are very strong and hard to see in certain light conditions, which is why they are most active during the pre-dawn and twilight hours. The webs can be used to create traps that can ensnare a person or to directly attack and entangle. They are highly stealthy and can hide their aura better than most monsters."
Humphrey gave Vincent an uncertain glance as he kept talking.
"Trap weavers roam in search of prey but return to a nest, usually in environments with water and dense trees. They use their webs to create traps that make invading their nests extremely difficult. This is especially true at the cusp of daylight, where their webs are the hardest to spot."
Humphrey's face went hard.
"Trap weavers usually spawn in groups, at least 2 or 3, and as many as 12 or 13. There have been some occurrences of higher numbers, although I'm not sure of the record."
19, Vincent said. "Outside of a monster surge. No one's counted the size of the swarms during a surge, but dozens of them."
"Using environmental and numerical advantages," Humphrey said, "trap weavers are responsible for more iron rank adventurer deaths than any other monster in the Greenstone region. There is a standing advisory that they should be dealt with in groups during daylight."
"Very comprehensive, Mr. Geller," Vincent said.
"I'm not done, sir," Humphrey said. "Instructor Trenslow has asked us to decide for ourselves which of us will deal with the trap weavers. I strongly recommend we choose no one. Fighting these creatures, especially now, is a danger I don't feel to be appropriate. There is a strong likelihood of some of us dying too quickly for Instructor Trenslow to intervene."
"I didn't ask for that, Mr. Geller."
"With respect, Instructor Trenslow," Humphrey shot back, "you instructed us to decide for ourselves who will participate. This is my contribution to that discussion."
Vincent looked at Humphrey, his expression unreadable.
"What about you, Mr. Asano?" Vincent asked.
Jason gave Vincent a long, assessing look before amusement crossed his face.
"Probably best I don't say anything either way," he said.
Humphrey looked at Jason, about to speak, but stopped at a slight shake of the head from Jason. Confusion crossed Humphrey's face, but he stayed silent. The other candidates who had already passed the assessment joined Humphrey in declining, leaving Mobley and the young woman who, like Jason, was yet to pass or fail. They looked at each other and also declined. Humphrey turned to Vincent.
"There's our group," Humphrey told him. "We choose no one."
"Very well," Vincent said, his face betraying nothing.
"Then I guess you should all get back in the wagon."
As promised, the town at which the group rested for the night had a large building for adventurers, with a common room, dining hall, and bedrooms enough for a dozen people. It was situated on the edge of a pond, with a covered terrace. They didn't arrive until after dark, and most of the group were gathered in the common room. Jason explored the sizable kitchen, but the cupboards and cooler box had no food, only crockery and cutlery. Jason made a salad with ingredients from the market towns they had passed through. He left a stack of bowls and forks next to the big salad bowl, filling two and taking a fork for each. He made his way through the common room, where the other candidates were discussing the day's events. In the end, Jason had killed both monsters, aside from the trap weavers they had left alone. He had no interest in the circle of unwelcome looks. instead making his way out to the terrace. The night was lit by a bright pair of moons, shining high over the surrounding wetlands. There was patio furniture on the terrace. Vincent casually reclined as he looked out into the night. Jason put a bowl and fork down on the table next to him before taking a seat himself. He pulled a couple of glasses from his inventory, along with a bottle. He poured a little bit of blue liquid into each glass.
"I think you'll like this," Jason said. "It has a fresh, crisp flavor that should go nicely with the salad."
"Thank you," Vincent said.
"For being so handsome?" Jason asked.
"It's attached to my face, so I had to bring it with me."
Vincent shook his head.
"Rufus told me you'd be trouble," Vincent said.
"He told me you were worth showing respect," Jason said.
"Sounds like disparate treatment to me."
Vincent nodded at the door Jason had emerged from.
"What are they doing in there?"
"Talking about the trap weavers," Jason said. "Humphrey's idea, of course."
"He's a diligent young man," Vincent said.
"Have they figured it out yet?"
"That we were never meant to fight them? They might get there. They might not. The rest are more interested in clamping onto the Geller family's leg."
"You haven't given them much of a chance," Vincent said.
"He seems to value your judgment, for reasons that escape me."
"My judgment is excellent, thank you very much," Jason said.
"Also, I think his mother wants him to learn something from me."
"Why?"
"You mean, what?"
"No, I meant, why? Has she actually met you?"
"Yes, as a matter of fact, she has.
You really do think my judgment is suspect, don't you?
You tried to start a fight with Thadwick Mercer the first time you met him." "If I tried to start a fight," Jason said, "then there would have been a fight. What I was doing was getting you to prevent a fight."
"For what conceivable reason would you do that?"
"Social advancement," Jason said. "If I get into it with Thadwick Mercer, then people see me as someone who operates at that level."
"Doesn't wandering around with Geller do that for you?"
"No, that makes me look like a hanger-on."
"I'm not sure outwitting Thadwick Mercer puts you any higher," Vincent said. "He's not one of the great minds of the younger generation."
"The point was to engage with Thadwick Mercer. Just that much puts me above a certain threshold, socially speaking," Jason said. "As for how far above, what do people see when they look closer?"
"They see you standing next to Humphrey Geller," Vincent said, realization dawning.
"Rufus has been very good to me," Jason said, "but he takes a somewhat top-down view of society, due to his upbringing, from what I understand. He wants me to reach a level of basic capability as an adventurer before certain facts come to light, but he's rather oblivious as to building social standing."
"I'm not sure your approach is the best way either," Vincent said. "In fact, I'm confident it isn't."
"Is that so?" Jason asked. "Less than 2 months ago, I walked into Greenstone with no name and no background. 2 weeks ago, I watched the symphony from the private viewing box of one of the city's most prominent families. 2 days ago, aristocrats were giving me death stares for my friendship with the son of the city's most powerful adventurer. 2 minutes ago, you and I started discussing my conflict with the nephew of the city's ruler."
"I'm not really sure what to say to that," Vincent said. "You realize there will be consequences for the way you're going about things?"
"Of course," Jason said. "But nothing is more impressive than handling the consequences of one's actions with grace and aplomb."
"And you can do that, can you?"
"I have absolutely no idea," Jason said with a laugh.
"Rufus warned me about you," Vincent said. "He said you were a man of malevolent intellect."
"That may be the nicest thing anyone has ever said about me."
"That's the nicest thing?"
"What we find complimentary is often subjective."
"You are a very strange man."
"That's just cultural differences," Jason said. "Where I come from, I'm perfectly ordinary."
And where is that exactly?
Maybe it is possible that I'm slightly unusual, Jason conceded, instead of answering the question.
Thank you, in any case, for not interfering when I told you to go after the trap weavers, Vincent said. Pointing out what I was doing would have been easy points for you, socially speaking.
No worries, Jason said. It's not the easy points that win the game.
You know why I haven't passed you yet, don't you?
I don't care what you tell us. You won't pass or fail anyone until the assessment is over.
True enough, Vincent said. Although I don't see Humphrey dropping down this time. He did well, taking leadership today. He had a similar chance last month and second-guessed himself into silence.
Did Rufus ask you to fail me, or did he just ask you to set the bar high?
If I was going to fail you arbitrarily, I wouldn't have brought you along.
Professionalism, Jason said. I can't ask for more than that.
Wait, yes, I can. What is it going to take to get a pass?
You're an affliction specialist, Vincent said. Something like the Bark Lurker would be trouble for most adventurers, but you handled it easily.
So why put me up against it?
You tell me.
Jason thought it over.
To make sure I can actually use my own specialty? He ventured.
There you are, Vincent said. So what will it take before I pass you?
Jason rubbed his chin thoughtfully.
Affliction specialist is a niche role, Jason pondered out loud. Just the thing to deal with a certain flavor of monster, but against ordinary ones, I'm just a slower version of any middle-of-the-road adventurer.
He glanced over at Vincent, whose expression gave away nothing.
If I want to pass, then, Jason reasoned, it isn't about beating the unusual monsters, because that's basic stuff for my ability set. It's about showing I can dominate the ordinary ones as well as any other adventurer. Am I close?
You'll find that out when the assessment is over, Vincent said. The door from the common room burst open.
Jason, Humphrey said, striding out onto the terrace. We were never meant to fight the trap weavers. We were meant to refuse. The whole thing was a test of leadership and judgment.
Shock and disappointment crossed Jason's face.
Is that true, instructor? He asked, turning on Vincent. Is something that devious even ethical?
Chapter 59 Falling Short. The adventurer accommodation had a dozen bedrooms, with three bathrooms shared between them. Jason found the bathrooms strange in their familiarity, tiled surfaces and magical plumbing. Jason was fresh out of the shower, with a towel around his waist. He was standing over a basin looking into the wall mirror as he washed cream off his face.
Stash!
Humphrey's voice yelled from the hall outside. It was followed by the door handle turning, and the bathroom door opened from the other side by some kind of chimp-like creature. It then turned into a bird that flew up and perched atop Jason's head, chirping triumphantly at its reflection in the mirror.
Sorry, Humphrey said from the door.
No worries, Jason said. Just so long as the bird he turns into is a small one.
What's that on your face?
Humphrey asked, standing outside the half-closed bathroom door.
Shaving cream.
Kind of, Jason said. You just leave it on for a few seconds, then any hair washes right off with the cream. An alchemist friend gave it to me.
You want to try?
I have a magic crystal that you rub on your face, Humphrey said. Anyway, I shaved yesterday. I don't need to do it every day.
Jason frowned. In the midst of a monster-hunting expedition, it was easy to forget that his fellow candidates were all 16 or 17 years old. Jason was only a half-dozen years their senior, but the idea of killing and dying at that age made him grateful he wasn't forced to grow up young.
"Seems like it would be easy to accidentally take off hair you wanted to keep," Humphrey said, oblivious to Jason's thoughts.
"I have some ointment that causes hair to grow," Jason said.
That's the one you want to be careful about applying. It works everywhere, whether hair is meant to grow there or not.
That makes sense, Humphrey said. I was wondering why you didn't have eyebrows when we met, but a couple of days later you did.
In the final days of the field assessment, some of the candidates began to realize the results weren't as decided as Vincent may have implied. Recognizing that coasting on what they thought was a done deal wasn't the best strategy, there was increased competition for each new monster they went after. Jason didn't push himself forwards as the others vied for additional chances to prove themselves, as he was still considering his approach to fighting monsters. Compared to even the most mediocre of his fellow candidates, Jason's abilities were slow and weak. A fire blast or magical sword strike could take down an ordinary monster in a fraction of the time it took Jason to apply his various afflictions. Worse was that in the time it took them to overcome the afflicted monster, it could well have ravaged any companions Jason had with him in the fight. His first thought was of his 8 unawakened essence abilities, but they would not help him in the remaining days of the field assessment unless he stumbled on a cache of awakening stones. Even if he did, his new abilities would likely be similar to those he already possessed. Jason's revelation came while watching Humphrey dispatch a group of monsters. They were dog-headed humanoids, with physiques like bodybuilders heavily into steroid abuse. Their jaws could produce a powerful bite, but their most dangerous feature was the sickle-like claws at the end of their arms. Combined with the crude clothing they fashioned for themselves with the flayed skin of their victims, they were an intimidating sight. The monsters were called Margols. Despite their appearance, they were not very dangerous individually, at least to a fully trained and equipped adventurer. The problem was that they always appeared in groups. As many as a dozen could appear at once, and they were highly aggressive, even for monsters. They were one of the monsters most dreaded by normal people. Every resident of the Delta heard stories of a Margol pack descending on a farm or ranch, or even attacking villages. Humphrey had not put himself forwards often since the early days of the field assessment, but he didn't hesitate to step out for the Margols. Rather than rely on his abilities, he used his combat skills to deal with the group. His martial techniques were most useful against humanoid enemies, and beyond summoning his sword and armor, he fought the monsters without powers. Jason was reminded of the way combat styles of his new world differed from those in his old one. Brazilian jiu-jitsu might be practical in an MMA fight, but have limited application against a crab the size of a delivery van. An acrobatic kick may get punished by a skilled human fighter, yet perfectly deliver a special attack to an inhuman monster. In all the time Rufus and the others had been training Jason, they devoted very little time to Jason's essence abilities. Outside of aura training, they largely left him to practice them on his own. Instead, they worked on his physicality, mentality, and skill. Everything but essence abilities. Rufus had been especially unrelenting in driving Jason to master the martial techniques that came from the skill book he used. Jason had sparred many times with Humphrey over the last few weeks as part of Rufus's ruthless regimen. And as he watched Humphrey dismantle the monsters, he realized that he had been far too focused on his essence abilities during the assessment. What worked perfectly against a bark lurker was pushing a square peg into a round hole against a small, quick rattling. The last day of the field assessment would close their looping path through the Delta, arriving back at Greenstone in the evening. They had spent the night in a barricade town, whose high walls and expansive lodgings were designed to be a safe haven during monster surges. Jason had stayed in a similar town in the desert with Rufus, Gary, and Farah, except this one had a sprawling stockyard in which to keep herds. Jason made his way out of the mud brick cabin he had shared with Humphrey, looking and feeling weary. His plan to put aside his slow essence abilities in favor of martial abilities hadn't worked as well as he had hoped. He was still able to put down the monsters, but not in the domineering fashion he was aiming for.
"Just give it time," Humphrey advised. "I've been training my whole life for this. You've been training for 2 months."
The group was assembling around the wagon when another wagon came bolting into town, drawn by 4 Heidels that were panting from how hard they'd been driven.
"Is it just me?" Vincent said. "Or do those look like some people in need of an adventurer? Everyone, form up!"
Vincent approached as the driver pulled up the wagon.
"You need some assistance,"
he asked. A bedraggled driver glanced back into the wagon before dropping down, looking over Vincent. Most people, whether in the Greenstone or the Delta, wore loose-fitting, breathable clothes because of the heat. Adventurers, at least while on the job, wore more fitted outfits, often with overt protective properties. They carried arrays of weapons and other useful gear. This was also true for the candidates, making their occupation obvious. To dispel any doubt, Vincent wore his brooch bearing the Adventure Society emblem. The driver explained that his family had escaped their nearby farm after a pack of Margols arrived. The only reason they got away was the Margols were caught up slaughtering their herd, giving the farmer time to load his family in the wagon and flee. This would make the fourth group of Margols the group had encountered in 3 days.
"Margols again," Mobley muttered. "Do you think it's a sign the monster surge is starting?"
"Possibly," Humphrey said. "But not likely. There hasn't been an increase in overall activity or a sharp rise in pack numbers. The first sign is usually when solitary monsters start appearing in groups." After getting details from the man, Vincent addressed the group.
"We're looking at a large pack," Vincent told them. "Somewhere around 10 to 12 Margols. Geller, are you comfortable handling that many?"
"I want it," Jason said, before Humphrey could answer. Mobley looked derisively at Jason.
"We've seen you fight Asano," he said. "You can't handle 12. You can't handle half of that."
Vincent looked contemplatively at Jason.
"Why?"
Vincent asked him.
"Because I know I've been falling short, even if I've been muddling along. If I'm going to break through, I need to be pushed harder, put myself in more danger."
Vincent considered it for a few moments.
"Geller," he said, finally, "you be ready to get him out when it goes wrong."
"You mean if it goes wrong?" Humphrey said.
"I know what I said, Geller."
Rufus, Gary, and Farrah had spent hour after hour, day after day, pounding Jason's fighting skill into a usable state. He had come further in just a few weeks than he would have imagined possible, but he wasn't close to matching a dozen monsters. As for the essence abilities he had been relying on in the early days of the assessment, nothing had changed. They were still too slow for a fast-paced battle.
"You don't have to do this," Humphrey told him.
"Let him," Mobley said. "I'd love to see that smug look frozen on his corpse."
Humphrey glared at Mobley.
"What's so great about him?" Mobley asked. "Sure, he handled the Bark Lurker and the Rune Tortoise, but against anything the rest of us could walk over, his powers are useless. So he gives up on the powers and starts just fighting them straight up? Sure, he's got some skills, but how long is an adventurer going to last when he fights without using his abilities? He's not even going to pass if he can't use his abilities and his combat skills together."
Jason's eyes shot open. Was it that simple? Had he really been that stupid? Jason's mistake came to him as a revelation. Somewhere in his head, he had been putting his martial arts in a box belonging to his old world, and his essence abilities in one belonging to the new. He had been crippling both by subconsciously separating the two.
"I'm an idiot," he said.
"I know," Mobley agreed. Jason spent the rest of the ride with a grin on his face, eyes flashing, as a floodgate opened in his mind. He could suddenly see with perfect clarity how badly he had been hamstringing himself. By the time the wagon turned off the embankment road and down a slope towards the farm, he was itching to begin. He was the first to vault out the back of the wagon. Vincent had stopped the wagon on the outskirts of the farm. In the distance, they could see a clutch of mud-brick farm buildings, past fields of a low, leafy crop. Vincent, still in the driving seat of the wagon, tossed Jason a far-sight crystal.
"We'll watch from here," Vincent said.
Margols had poor vision and aura sense, but their smell and hearing were highly sensitive. The group would see everything through the crystal without interfering with Jason's fight. As Jason marched away without pause, Humphrey followed. He maintained enough distance that he wouldn't interfere either, but could still intervene if necessary. Jason neared the farm's largest building, a big, square barn. As he did, a Margol came wandering out, chewing on the remains of what, to Jason, looked like the family dog. Somehow the idea of a dog-headed monster eating a dog made it even more disgusting. The monster sniffed the air, then turned to Jason, dropping its meal in the dirt. Jason had never been this close to a Margol before. It had the face of a pit bull and the body of a powerlifter, with sickle-claw hands. Its arms were drenched up to the elbows in blood, as was its wide mouth. It threw its head back, letting out a wild howl. Chapter 60 Making Music. Jason and the Margol faced off outside the mud brick barn. The Margol's howl called out more, who emerged from in and around the building to join it. As they assembled, Jason and the first one remained where they stood, gazes locked. Jason was the first to move, walking closer to the wall of the barn. That first step was like a starter's pistol, the monsters lunging into a sprint. Jason kept walking casually as the creatures closed the distance, pounding over the dirt. When they were almost upon him, he dropped into the shadow of the building like falling through a manhole. He rose up from the ground behind the monsters, silently emerging from one of the Margol's own shadows. In the brief but crucial moment of confusion, Jason noticed the Margol in front of him had loose skin at the back of its neck, like a dog. He grabbed a fistful of skin and yanked back, pulling the monster off balance. The creatures were already wheeling on Jason, so when his dagger tore the throat out of the monster in his grip, blood sprayed over the others. "You have defeated Margol. Would you like to loot Margol?" He shoved the dead monster forwards as it dissolved into rainbow smoke. The stench was horrifying, but bearable for Jason. Fortunately, he lacked the powerful sense of smell the Margols had. For them, the smoke was like tear gas, the closest ones staggering away with dog-like yelps of misery. The group of Margols was large enough that those furthest from Jason weren't disabled, although they were scattered and distracted. Jason moved right into their midst, making full use of his martial skills in the chaos. Another Margol dropped dead, throat slashed open. A forceful kick to the side of the knee sent one dropping to the ground. Jason's flashing dagger inflicted more injuries, non-lethal, but distracting enough to keep the monsters off balance while they were still reeled from the smoke. Weapon, Nightfang, has inflicted Umbral Snake Venom on Margol. Special attack, Punish, has inflicted Sin on Margol. Aura, Hegemony, reduces the resistance of enemies for each instance of Sin